Chapter 7. The Hill of the Strange Trenches. There is no denying it was a beast of a day. Overhead was a sunless sky, muffled in clouds that were heavy with snow. Underfoot, a black frost, blowing over it a wind that felt as if it would take your skin off. When they got down into the plain, they found that this part of the ancient road was much more ruinous than any they had yet seen. They had to pick their way over great broken stones and between boulders and across rubble, hard going for sore feet. And however tired they got, it was far too cold for a halt. At about 10 o'clock, the first tiny snowflakes came loitering down and settled on Jill's arm. 10 minutes later, they were falling quite thickly. In 20 minutes, the ground was noticeably white. And by the end of half an hour, a good steady snowstorm, which looked as if it meant to last all day, was driving in their faces so that they could hardly see. In order to understand what followed, you must keep on remembering how little they could see. As they drew near the low hill which separated them from the place where the lighted windows had appeared, they had no general view of it at all. It was a question of seeing the next few paces ahead, and even for that, you had to screw up your eyes. Needless to say, they were not talking. When they reached the foot of the hill, they caught a glimpse of what might be rocks on each side, squarish rocks, if you looked at them carefully, but no one did. All were more concerned with the ledge right in front of them, which barred their way. It was about 4 feet high. The marsh wiggle, with his long legs, had no difficulty in jumping onto the top of it, and he then helped the others up. It was a nasty wet business for them, though not for him, because the snow now lay quite deep on the ledge. They then had a stiff climb, Jill fell once, up very rough ground for about 100 yards, and came to a second ledge. There were 4 of these ledges altogether at quite irregular intervals. As they struggled onto the 4th ledge, there was no mistaking the fact that they were now at the top of the flat hill. Up till now, the slope had given them some shelter. Here, they got the full fury of the wind, for the hill, oddly enough, was quite as flat on top as it had looked from a distance, a great level tableland which the storm tore across without resistance. In most places the snow was still hardly lying at all, for the wind kept catching it up off the ground in sheets and clouds and hurling it in their faces. And round their feet little eddies of snow ran about as you sometimes see them doing over ice. And indeed in many places the surface was almost as smooth as ice. But to make matters worse, it was crossed and crisscrossed with curious banks, or dikes, which sometimes divided it up into squares and oblongs. All these, of course, had to be climbed. They varied from 2 to 5 feet in height, and were about a couple of yards thick. On the north side of each bank, the snow already lay in deep drifts, and after each climb you came down into a drift and got wet. Fighting her way forward with hood up and head down and numb hands inside her cloak, Jill had glimpses of other odd things on that horrible tableland. Things on her right that looked vaguely like factory chimneys, and on her left a huge cliff, straighter than any cliff ought to be. But she wasn't at all interested, and didn't give them a thought. The only things she thought about were her cold hands, and nose and chin and ears, and hot baths and beds at Harfang. Suddenly, she skidded, slid about 5 feet, and found herself, to her horror, sliding down into a dark, narrow chasm, which seemed that moment to have appeared in front of her. Half a second later, she had reached the bottom. She appeared to be in a kind of trench, or groove, only about 3 feet wide. And though she was shaken by the fall, almost the first thing she noticed was the relief of being out of the wind, for the walls of the trench rose high above her. The next thing she noticed was, naturally, the anxious faces of Scrub and Puddleglum looking down at her from the edge.
"Are you hurt, Pole?" shouted Scrub. "Both legs broken, I shouldn't wonder," shouted Puddleglum.
Jill stood up and explained that she was all right, but they'd have to help her out.
"What is it you've fallen into?" asked Scrub. "It's a kind of trench, or it might be a kind of sunken lane or something," said Jill. "It runs quite straight." "Yes, by Jove," said Scrub, "and it runs due north. I wonder, is it a sort of a road? If it was, we'd be out of this infernal wind down there. Is there a lot of snow at the bottom?" "Hardly any. It all blows over the top, I suppose." "What happened further on?" "Half a sec, I'll go and see," said Jill.
She got up and walked along the trench, but before she'd gone far, it turned sharply to the right. She shouted this information back to the others.
"What's round the corner?" asked Scrub.
Now, it happened that Jill had the same feeling about twisty passages and dark places underground, or even nearly underground, that Scrub had about the edges of cliffs. She had no intention of going round that corner alone, especially when she heard Puddleglum bawling out from behind her,
"Be careful, Pole! It's just the sort of place that might lead to a dragon's cave, and in a giant country there might be giant earthworms or giant beetles."
"I don't think it goes anywhere much," said Jill, coming hastily back.
"I'm jolly well going to have a look," said Scrub. "What do you mean by anywhere much, I should like to know?"
So he sat down on the edge of the trench. Everyone was too wet by now to bother about being a bit wetter, and then dropped in. He pushed past Jill, and though he didn't say anything, she felt sure that he knew she had funked it. So she followed him closely, but took care not to get in front of him. It proved, however, a disappointing exploration. They went round the right-hand turn, and straight on for a few paces. Here there was a choice of ways, straight on again, or sharp to the right.
"That's no good," said Scrub, glancing down the right-hand turn. "That would be taking us back, south."
He went straight on, but once more, in a few steps, they found a second turn to the right. But this time there was no choice of ways, for the trench they'd been following here came to a dead end.
"No good," grunted Scrub.
Jill lost no time in turning and leading the way back. When they returned to the place where Jill had first fallen in, the Marsh Wiggle, with his long arms, had no difficulty in pulling them out, but it was dreadful to be out on top again. Down in those narrow slits of trenches, their ears had almost begun to thaw. They'd been able to see clearly and breathe easily and hear each other speak without shouting. It was absolute misery to come back into the withering coldness. And it did seem hard when Puddleglum chose that moment for saying,
"You still sure of those signs, Pole? What's the one we ought to be after now?"
"Oh, come on, bother the sign," said Pole. "Something about someone mentioning Aslan's name, I think, but I'm jolly well not going to give a recitation here."
As you see, she had got the order wrong. That was because she had given up saying the signs over every night. She still really knew them if she troubled to think, but she was no longer so pat in her lesson as to be sure of reeling them off in the right order at a moment's notice and without thinking. Puddleglum's question annoyed her because, deep down inside her, she was already annoyed with herself for not knowing the lion's lesson quite so well as she felt she ought to have known it. This annoyance, added to the misery of being very cold and tired, made her say, "Bother the signs." She didn't perhaps quite mean it.
"Oh, that was next, was it?" said Puddleglum. "Now I wonder, are you right? Or mixed, I shouldn't wonder. Seems to me this hill, this flat place we're on, is worth stopping to have a look at. Have you noticed?"
"Oh, law," said Scrub. "Is this a time for stopping to admire the view? For goodness sake, let's get on."
"Oh, look, look, look," cried Jill and pointed. Everyone turned. And everyone saw.
Some way off to the north, and a good deal higher up than the tableland on which they stood, a line of lights had appeared. This time, even more obviously than when the travellers had seen them the night before, they were windows. Smaller windows that made one think deliciously of bedrooms, and larger windows that made one think of great halls, with fires roaring on the hearth and hot soup or juicy sirloins smoking on the table.
"Harfang!" exclaimed Scrub.
"It's all very well," said Puddleglum, "but what I was saying was..."
"Oh, shut up!" said Jill crossly. "We haven't a moment to lose. Don't you remember what the lady said about their locking up so early? We must get there in time. We must, we must. We'll die if we're shut out on a night like this."
"Well, isn't exactly a night, not yet," began Puddleglum, but the two children both said, "Come on," and began stumbling forward on the slippery tableland as quickly as their legs would carry them. The Marshwiggle followed them, still talking, but now that they were forcing their way into the wind again, they could not have heard him even if they had wanted to, and they didn't want. They were thinking of baths and beds and hot drinks, and the idea of coming to Harfang too late and being shut out was almost unbearable. In spite of their haste, it took them a long time to cross the flat top of that hill, and even when they had crossed it, there were still several ledges to climb down on the far side. But at last they reached the bottom and could see what Harfang was like. It stood on a high crag, and in spite of its many towers, was more a huge house than a castle. Obviously the gentle giants feared no attack. There were windows in the outside wall quite close to the ground, a thing no one would have in a serious fortress. There were even odd little doors here and there, so that it would be quite easy to get in and out of the castle without going through the courtyard. This raised the spirits of Jill and Scrub, made the whole place look more friendly and less forbidding. At first, the height and steepness of the crag frightened them, but presently they noticed that there was an easier way up on the left, and that the road wound up towards it. It was a terrible climb after the journey they had already had, and Jill nearly gave up. Scrub and Puddleglum had to help her for the last 100 yards, but in the end they stood before the castle gate. The portcullis was up and the gate open. However tired you are, it takes some nerve to walk up to a giant's front door. In spite of all his previous warnings against Harfang, it was Puddleglum who showed most courage.
"Steady pace now," he said. "Don't look frightened, whatever you do. We've done the silliest thing in the world by coming at all, but now that we are here, we'd best put a bold face on it."
With these words, he strode forward into the gateway, stood still under the arch where the echo would help his voice, and called out as loud as he could,
"Ho! Porter! Guests who seek lodging!"
And while he was waiting for something to happen, he took off his hat and knocked off the heavy mass of snow which had gathered on its wide brim.
"I say," whispered Scrub to Jill, "he may be a wet blanket, but he has plenty of pluck and cheek."
A door opened, letting out a delicious glow of firelight, and the porter appeared. Jill bit her lips for fear she should scream. He was not a perfectly enormous giant, that is to say, he was rather taller than an apple tree, but nothing like so tall as a telegraph pole. He had bristly red hair, a leather jerkin with metal plates fastened all over it so as to make a kind of mail shirt, bare knees, very hairy indeed, and things like putties on his legs. He stooped down and goggled at Puddleglum.
"And what sort of creature do you call yourself?" he said.
Jill took her courage in both hands. "Please," she said, shouting up at the giant, "the Lady of the Green Kirtle salutes the King of the Gentle Giants and has sent us 2 southern children and this Marshwiggle, his name's Puddleglum, to your autumn feast, if it's quite convenient, of course," she added.
"Uh-huh," said the porter. "That's quite a different story. Come in, little people, come in. You best come into the lodge while I'm sending word to His Majesty."
He looked at the children with curiosity.
"Blue faces," he said. "I didn't know they were that colour."
"Don't care about it myself. but I dare say you look quite nice to one another. Beetles fancy other beetles, they do say.
Our faces are only blue with cold, said Jill. We're not this colour, really.
Then come in and get warm. Come in, little shrimps, said the porter.
They followed him into the lodge, and though it was rather terrible to hear such a big door clang shut behind them, they forgot about it as soon as they saw the thing they'd been longing for ever since supper time the previous night, a fire, and such a fire. It looked as if four or five whole trees were blazing on it, and it was so hot they couldn't go within yards of it. But they all flopped down on the brick floor as near as they could bear the heat, and heaved great sighs of relief.
"Now, youngster," said the porter to another giant who had been sitting in the back of the room staring at the visitors till it looked as if his eyes would start out of his head, "run across with this message to the house."
And he repeated what Jill had said to him. The younger giant, after a final stare and a great guffaw, left the room.
"Now, Froggy," said the porter to Puddleglum. "You look as if you wanted some cheering up."
He produced a black bottle very like Puddleglum's own, but about 20 times larger.
Let me see, said the porter. "I can't give you a cup or you'll drown yourself. Let me see. This salt cellar will be just the thing. You needn't mention it over at the house. The silver will keep on getting over here, and it's not my fault."
The salt cellar was not very like one of ours, being narrower and more upright, and made quite a good cup for Puddleglum when the giant set it down on the floor beside him. The children expected Puddleglum to refuse it, distrusting the gentle giants as he did, but he muttered,
"It's rather late to be thinking of precautions now that we're inside and the door's shut behind us."
Then he sniffed at the liquor.
"Smells all right," he said. "But that's nothing to go by. Better make sure."
And took a sip.
"Tastes all right, too," he said. "But it might do that at the first sip. How does it go on?"
He took a larger sip.
"Ah," he said. "But is it the same all the way down?"
And took another.
"There'll be something nasty at the bottom, I shouldn't wonder," he said, and finished the drink. He licked his lips and remarked to the children, "This'll be a test. You see, if I curl up or burst or turn into a lizard or something, then you'll know not to take anything they offer you."
But the giant, who was too far up to hear the things Puddleglum had been saying under his breath, roared with laughter and said,
"Why, Froggy, you're a man. See him put it away."
"Not a man. Marsh Wiggle," replied Puddleglum in a somewhat indistinct voice. "Not frog neither. Marsh Wiggle."
At that moment the door opened behind them, and the younger giant came in saying,
"Had to go to the throne room at once."
The children stood up, but Puddleglum remained sitting and said,
"Marsh Wiggle. Marsh Wiggle. Very respectable Marsh Wiggle. Respect a wiggle." "Show them the way, young'un," said the giant porter. "You better carry Froggy. He's had a drop more than's good for him."
"There's nothing wrong with me," said Puddleglum. "Not a frog. Nothing frog with me. I'm a respectable."
But the young giant caught him up by the waist and signed to the children to follow. In this undignified way they crossed the courtyard. Puddleglum, held in the giant's fist and vaguely kicking the air, did certainly look very like a frog. But they had little time to notice this, for they soon entered the great doorway of the main castle. Both their hearts were beating faster than usual, and after pattering along several corridors at a trot to keep up with the giant's paces, found themselves blinking in the light of an enormous room, where lamps glowed and a fire roared on the hearth, and both were reflected from the gilding of roof and cornice. More giants than they could count stood on their left and right, all in magnificent robes, and on two thrones at the far end sat two huge shapes that appeared to be the king and queen.
About 20 feet from the thrones, they stopped. Scrub and Jill made an awkward attempt at a bow. Girls are not taught how to curtsy at Experiment House. And the young giant carefully put Puddleglum down on the floor, where he collapsed into a sort of sitting position. With his long limbs, he looked, to tell the truth, uncommonly like a large spider.